Cellini stood in the shadows and listened to the drunken bellowing and laughter from the king's tent. Beneath the short cloak was concealed the leather grain bag, a bundle of smoked meat, dried into hard black sticks, and a small earthen cooking pot. There was food for two of them for 4 days, and by then they would be across the great river. She was fearful and elated at the same time. They'd planned this moment for 2 years, and many emotions played behind her round, impassive face as she waited. Timon came at last. Quietly he appeared beside her, with such suddenness that she gasped with fright. He took her hand and led her away towards the perimeter of the camp. She saw that he wore a cloak also, and that a bow and quiver stood behind his shoulder, and a short iron sword was belted at his waist. These were weapons forbidden to a slave, and death was the penalty for carrying them. There were two guards at the gate of the stockade, and while Cellini spoke with them, offering favours, Timon came from the darkness behind them. He broke their necks with his bare hands, taking one in each hand and shaking them the way a dog will shake a rat. There was no outcry, and Simon laid the bodies gently beside the stockade gate, and they went through. They passed through the saucer where the elephant had been butchered, and the night was hideous with the snarling and yammering of the scavengers. Hyena and jackal fought over the bloody scraps and bone chips. With the sword bared in one hand, Timon led Cellini through, and though the slinking, hump-shouldered hyena followed them, moaning and sniggering, they reached the pass and started down the elephant road into the valley. The moon gave them good light, and they moved fast. They stopped only once at the ford of the stream to rest and drink a little water, then they hurried on towards the north. Once they came upon a lion in the path, a big male whose body was ghostly grey in the moonlight with a dark ruff of mane. They stared at each other for long seconds before the lion grunted softly and leapt into the undergrowth beside the path. He had fed recently, and the two human shapes didn't interest him. The moon, 4 days past full, wheeled across the star-furry sky and sank towards the dark horizon. When it set, there was only the indistinct glow of the stars to light their way, and at a steep and broken place in the path, Cellini fell heavily. Timon heard her cry out, and he turned back quickly. She was lying on her side, making a soft moaning sound. "Are you hurt?" he asked, as he dropped to his knees beside her. "My ankle," she whispered, agony making her voice husky, and Timon groped down her leg. Already the ankle was hot to the touch, and as he held it, he could feel it swelling, blowing up into a hard, hot ball. With the sword, Timon cut strips from his cloak, and he bound the ankle tightly, as Hui had taught him. He worked with frantic haste, and the worms of dread were already gnawing his guts. When he lifted Cellini to her foot, she cried out as her weight came onto the injured one.
"Can you walk on it?" Timon asked.
And she tried a few painful, hobbling steps. She was panting with pain, and her breathing whistled in her throat. She clung to Timon and shook her head hopelessly. "I cannot go on. Leave me here." Timon lowered her to the ground, and then straightened up as he discarded his weapons and her provisions. He kept only the short sword. He folded and knotted the two leather cloaks into a sling seat for Cellini, and placed it about her body. Then he looped the end over his neck and shoulder and lifted her. She was in his arms, with her own clasped about his shoulders. Half of her weight was taken by the sling, hanging about Timon's neck. He started forward, striding out down the steep path towards the valley floor. By mid-morning, the sling had rubbed the skin from his neck, a weeping pink graze through the dark skin. The heat was strong now, that heavy, oppressive heat of the valley floor sucking away the last of his energy. The spring had long gone from Timon's steps, and he reeled forward with spirit outlasting his physical strength. On the edge of one of the glades of open grass, Timon stopped and leaned against the trunk of a mobahoba tree. He was afraid to lower the girl's body to the ground, lest he couldn't find the strength to lift it again. His lips were white and rimmed with dried spittle, and his eyes were laced with red veins. His chest heaved and shook with his breathing. "Leave me, Timon," Selene whispered. "This way both of us will die." Timon didn't answer, but gestured her to silence with an impatient inclination of his head. He held his breath and listened, and she heard it also then, the faint and distant baying of the hound pack. He said, "It is too late for that," and he looked about quickly for a place to stand. They couldn't hope to outrun the dogs. "You can still escape," she urged him. "The river's not far."
"Without you, there is no escape," he said.
And she clung to him as he carried her across the glade to a place where the mother rock outcropped, a jumble of fragmented granite like the ruins of an ancient castle. He laid her gently amongst the rocks with her back against one of the slabs. He folded her cloak and placed it as a pillow for her head. Then he squatted beside her and caressed her face and neck with a surprisingly gentle touch for so big a man. "They will kill us," Selene said. "They always kill those who run." Timon didn't answer, but his fingers stroked her cheek lightly. "They kill in the worst way," Selene said, turning her head to look at him. "Would it not be better if we died now, before the dogs came?" But he didn't answer, and after a while she went on. "You have the sword, Timon. Will you not use it?"
"If the little priest is with them, then we have a chance. He has power over the king. And there is a thing between him and me. There is a bond. He will save us."
The dogs were closer now, and it seemed that their baying had become more urgent as the scent ran hotter. Timon stood up and unsheathed the sword. He went out amongst the rocks and looked back towards the escarpment. Half a mile back, the pack streamed from the forest into the glade. There were 30 of the tall, sinewy hounds, long-legged and with rough ginger-brown coats, and the heads and fangs of wolves. They were bred to chase and drag down the quarry. Timon felt his skin tighten and prickle as he watched them strung out along the grade towards him. Behind them, running on the heels of the pack, were the handlers, with their distinctive green tunics and the dog whips over their shoulders. Beyond them again came the war elephants, 5 of them, with the knights and slave masters in their castles. The elephants followed the pack easily in that ambling gait which could cover 50 miles in a day. Timon shaded his eyes and tried to pick out the distinctive figure of the priest amongst the men in the castles. They were still too far off, but the hounds were closing swiftly. He wrapped his cloak carefully about his left forearm and settled his grip on the sword, swinging the weapon in a short arc to stretch his muscles. The leading hound saw him amongst the rocks, and immediately the deep, regular baying changed to an excited yammering. Their ears flattened as they ran, and the long pink tongues flopped over white fangs in the wolf jaws, and they fanned out across his front. Timon stepped back into the opening where Selene lay, guarding her from the vicious, clamoring rush of brown bodies. The first hound rushed in at him, with its jaws snapping, and it leapt at his face. Simon took him on the point in the base of his throat, killing the dog instantly. But before he could clear his blade, another had sprung at him. He thrust his cloaked arm into its jaws and hacked at a third hound. They swarmed over him as he stabbed and hacked and thrust. He swung the hound that hung on his arm against the rock beside him, crushing in its ribs. But another had locked his fangs in his calf and was tugging him cruelly off balance. He drove the point into its shaggy back, and the hound shrieked and released him. Another went for his face, and he struck at its head with a sword hilt. A great furry body smashed into his chest. A fang ripped his shoulder muscles. There were too many of them, overwhelming him, ripping and tearing at him, smothering him with their weight and strength. He went down on his knees, holding a frothing, slavering animal away from his throat and face with one hand, strangling it, but he felt other teeth slashing at his back and belly and thighs. And then abruptly the dog handlers were there, whipping the pack away from him, shouting to the animals by name, dragging them back, and leashing them in the strangling collars. Slowly, Timon pulled himself up onto his feet. He had lost his sword, and blood streamed down his shining black body from the deep cuts and lacerations that covered him. He looked up at the war elephant which towered over him. His last hope faded as he saw that Hui Ben Ammon was not amongst the hunters, and that Lannan Hyckinus, the Grey Lion of Opet, was laughing.
"A good run, slave," Lannan laughed. "I thought that you might reach the river."
He looked beyond Timon to where Selene lay.
"Ah, my hunt masters were correct, then. They judged by the sign that the woman had damaged her leg and that you were carrying her. A noble gesture, slave, and most unusual for a pagan. All the same, it will cost you dear."
Lannan looked away to one of his slave masters.
"There seems to be little gained by returning with them. Execute them here."
Timon looked up at the king and spoke in a strong, clear voice.
"I am the living symbol of that love," he said.
And Lannan's head jerked around as he remembered the words. With the laughter gone from his lips, he stared at the bleeding slave king, meeting those smoky yellow eyes. For long seconds, Timon's life teetered on the verge of extinction. And then, suddenly, Lannan's eyes dropped away from those of Timon.
"Very well," he nodded. "You remind me of my duty to a friend. I will honor it. But I swear you will live to curse the moment you spoke those words. You will live, but in life you will long for the sweetness of death."
Lannan's face was a mask of cold anger as he turned back to his slave masters.
"This man will not be executed, but he is declared incorrigible, and he will be chained with a weight of 2 talents.
Almost 100 pounds weight of chains, to be carried night and day, waking and sleeping.
Send him to the mines at Hulia, and tell the overseer that he is to be used at the deep levels."
Lannan watched Timon's face as he went on.
"The woman cannot claim my protection, but we will take her back with us nonetheless. Let her be chained to the castle of one of the war elephants and marched."
For the first time, Timon showed emotion. He stepped forward and in appeal lifted one badly savaged arm from which the dark, tattered flesh hung.
"My lord, the woman is hurt. She cannot walk."
"She will walk," said Lannan, "or she will be dragged. You will ride upon the elephant and encourage her. You will have time to decide if the swift death I offered you would not have been preferable to the life you have chosen." They chained Selene at the wrists with a light marching chain 20 paces long. The other end of the chain was shackled to the rear wall of the elephant castle. Timon, wearing his massive chains at neck and ankles, was seated in the castle. He was made to face backwards to where Selene stood swaying slightly on one leg, favoring her grotesquely swollen ankle. Her face was greyish with pain, but she tried to smile up at Timon. The first jerk of the chain as the elephant started forward pulled her face downwards on the hard earth, with its sharp shale and harsh clumps of razor grass. She was dragged 50 paces before she managed to roll onto her feet again and hop and stumble after the striding elephant. Her knees and elbows were raw, and there were scratches across her belly and breasts. She fell and regained her feet 12 times. Each time her body was more battered and torn. She went down for the last time, a little before sunset. As Timon sat in the castle, draped in his chains, he swore an oath. In his anger and grief and pain, he swore an oath of vengeance. Watching Selene's lifeless body bounce and slide over the rough places, leaving a damp brown smear across the dry red African earth. And then Timon wept. For the last time in his life, he succumbed to tears. They ran down his face and dripped from his chin to mingle with the blood and the dust that caked his body. Hui filled a wine bowl from one of his choice amphorae, one that he'd set aside for a rare occasion. He was humming softly to himself, and there was a small smile which came and went upon his lips and made his dark eyes sparkle. He had returned to Opet in the middle of the night, slept 5 hours, and now, bathed and dressed in his best linen, he had sent a slave to summon the Oracle of Opet to meet with him. All the blood and passion of these last weeks upon the escarpment of the great river were forgotten now, in anticipation of his reunion with Tanith. Forgotten were the memories of Selene's mutilated corpse, dragged into camp behind the war elephant, the tall figure of Timon, bowed beneath his chains in grief, led away by the slave masters, those terrible accusing eyes turned towards Hui, the manacled wrists lifted in a gesture of menace, or of appeal. Hui couldn't guess which. Then the slave master's whip, hissing and snapping across the purple-black shoulders, lifting a welter as thick as a finger without cutting the skin. For the first time since it had happened, Hui was free of it, his whole being taken up with the joy of his love. Pursing his lips thoughtfully, he let 4 drops of the clear liquid drip from the blue glass vial into the wine. He stopped the bottle and stirred the wine with his forefinger, sucking his finger thoughtfully and wrinkling his nose at the faint, musty taste of the opiate. He added a little wild honey to mask it, tasted again, and at last, satisfied, he set the bowl on one of the wooden stools beside the pile of cushions. There was a dish of cakes and sweetmeats there already. Hui covered the wine bowl with a silken cloth, and then surveyed his preparations with pleasure. He picked up his lute and climbed the staircase to the parapet of the roof and seated himself. He tuned the instrument and strummed upon it, loosening his voice and fingers, watching the narrow lane that led up to the front gate.